First case on our calendar, 03-1081 and 1092, Michael Gilchrist versus Arthur M. Gonsor et al. Mr. Garner.
May it please the court, counsel, Richard Garner on behalf of appellants. My intention is to reserve 3 minutes on rebuttal. In this case, Michael Gilchrist was injured by a drunk driver while he was in the course and scope of his employment for United Rentals. The drunk driver was underinsured. Now Mr. Gilchrist seeks underinsured motorist coverage from his employer's fronting policy that was issued by Appellant United States Fidelity and Guarantee Company, USF&G. The trial court in the 8th Appellate District ruled that the policy provided Ohio underinsured motorist coverage. However, we believe these decisions are wrong and that they should be reversed, because the USF&G policy does not provides neither express nor implied Ohio underinsured motorist coverage. As a preliminary matter, it's important to understand that the USF&G policy does not expressly provide Ohio underinsured motorist coverage anywhere. To the extent it's necessary, I'll address this in greater detail in rebuttal or with the court's questions, but if Ohio underinsured motorist coverage is provided by this policy, it must be provided by operation of law or not at all.
Counsel, was underinsured motorist coverage offered to United Rental?
I don't believe the record reflects that, Your Honor. I think the record would indicate.
Well, was it? Is there any record that it was offered?
No, Your Honor.
Justice Pfeiffer, there's any record it was rejected?
No, Your Honor. There is no rejection in this case.
All right.
If underinsured motorist coverage is to be provided in this case,
what does Ohio law provide for?
Excuse me?
Doesn't Ohio law require at that time it be offered?
It would depend
upon.
And
if it's not offered and rejected, it is imposed by operation of law.
And that would be the crux of this case, Justice Pfeiffer, whether or not a fronting policy of this type is subject.
A fronting policy, where does that term come from? Is that on the policy?
No, Your Honor, it is not.
Is it referred to in the statutes of this state?
No, Your Honor, it's referred to in the case law of this state and in the case law throughout the country, which recognizes the fronting policies employing matching deductibles are a form of self-insurance.
And what case do you rely on for that in our state?
Well, in this case, Your Honor, there would be 9 of Ohio's 12 appellate districts have addressed this issue and addressed this court's unanimous decision in Grange Mutual Casualty Company versus Refiners.
And did Grange refer to a fronting policy?
No, Your Honor. Grange Mutual Casualty Company versus Refiners addressed a certified self-insurer and perhaps a bondholder. But the courts have taken this and logically extended it out to its logical conclusion, which is that when we have a self-insurance program, such as a fronting policy employing a matching deductible, then in fact we're talking about the same thing as we talk about with
what,
a certified.
What does this policy provide in states that require underinsured motorist coverage?
In states that require underinsured motorist
yes.
coverage? Well, the policy actually provides uninsured and underinsured motorist coverage in 3 states. Kansas, right. Nebraska, and Oregon. And in those particular states, there is uninsured and underinsured motorist coverage provided by this policy.
But you argue in your reply brief that no corporation should even have under an uninsured motorist coverage.
Well, what I argue in the reply brief, which is an interesting issue I wasn't planning on addressing an oral argument in detail, but it's essentially this. In this court's decision in Scott Ponser, this court said if we extend Ohio uninsured, underinsured motorist coverage directly to a corporation, it's meaningless and we create an ambiguity. As a result, we pointed out in our reply brief that if this court were to impose.
No, I think Ponser said that the term you created an ambiguity, but here, as you acknowledge, this injured employee was a named insured under the policy, was he not?
No, he was not a named insured.
He was not.
The only way that he gets coverage in this case is if Scott Ponser is applied,
as limited
by the Gladys case.
Is he not a named insured?
He is not a named insured, Justice Breyer.
Isn't every employee named as an insured under the policy? Isn't that what the policy says?
Not this policy, no, Your Honor. And in fact, there are references that are made by Appellee in this case that said, but if you read the provisions that he actually cites to, they indicate employees for liability coverage when they're in covered autos.
Right.
This is not the situation that we have here. Here we have Mr. Gilchrist as a pedestrian.
But that was not Ponser. Ponser related to the reference to you.
And I would
here, the employee is specifically named as covered under the policy.
I would disagree with you, Justice Pfeiffer, and I would disagree with the fact that Scott Ponser dealt solely with the question of the word you. Scott Ponser, my understanding of the case is that we were talking about a situation whenever uninsured motorist coverage is extended directly to a corporate named insured. The use of the word you would be irrelevant if I called it the named insured and it still extended UM/UIM coverage directly to the corporation, we would probably still have the same ambiguity this court was concerned about in Scott Ponser. And so the only way that Mr. Gilchrist is able to get coverage in this case is under the Scott Ponser case. The reason why we pointed out what we did in our reply brief about questioning whether or not this court should ever impose UM coverage by operation of law when there's a corporate named insured on the policy is because if you do that, you're creating the very ambiguity that you pointed out was a problem in the Scott Ponser case. I think that the law should not require this sort of thing to happen. If there is no reason for the rule to be applied, that is, if the corporation cannot use the coverage that you're going to impose by operational law, why in the world would we possibly give it directly to the corporation? The argument in this case, though, we believe that the policy does not provide underinsured motorist coverage expressly. So the only way that we can get there is if it provides underinsured motorist coverage by operation of law. And to do that, obviously, we need to look at the issue of whether and how 393718 is to be applied to this policy. Now, I will submit something that I don't believe is controversial, and that is that everyone in this courtroom, including Mr. Wakefield, will likely agree that former 393718 is not applicable to self-insurers. This court's unanimous opinion in Grange Mutual Casualty Company versus Refiners established that fact. And if you go throughout the United States and look at statutes similar to Ohio statute, we see that this is the national majority position.
So, Counselor, your burden here is to convince that this matching deductible is, in fact, the functional equivalent of a self-insured situation that would exempt it from former statute.
I would agree, Justice O'Connor, and that's exactly the point that I was going to get to here, which is that the real question, I think Justice Pfeiffer hit on it, is Refiners limited to certified self-insurers and bondholders, or does it extend to other self-insurance programs, such as the type we have here, that involve a matching deductible, or other programs that might involve a captive reinsurer, a captive insurer, or other risk retention programs? What I'll suggest to you is that the overwhelming weight of legal authority in this country and in this state demonstrates that this type of a policy employing a matching deductible is, in fact, a form of self-insurance. We see this borne out in five different areas, support for this proposition in five different areas. Number one, the Ohio cases. In Ohio, of the 12 appellate districts that we have, 11 of them have considered this issue. Of those 11, 9, including the 8th appellate district in a subsequent case, and the 12th appellate district, which sent this court the Tucker versus Wilson case, have held that the Refiners case extends to fronting policies that employ matching deductibles. All of these cases rely upon Refiners, and interestingly, this line of cases predates the Scott Ponser phenomena. The Scott Ponser phenomena obviously is what made this issue so widely litigated in the state, but this case was first decided in 1993 by the 6th Appellate District in McCollum versus Continental Insurance Company. So this was not a response to Scott Ponser. This was a well-established line of authority that predated Scott Ponser. Second, we see that this proposition that fronting policies that employ matching deductibles are in fact a form of self-insurance is borne out by the cases outside of Ohio. We have provided this court with more than a dozen cases from outside of Ohio which demonstrate that fronting policies are a form of self-insurance. It's interesting to note that Mr. Wakefield in his brief has offered this court nothing from outside of Ohio, and I will suggest to this court that this is the national majority position. We also see support for our position drawn from the federal income tax cases that we have provided to this court, which treat fronting policies using captive insurers as self-insurance. This is significant for the entities that are involved in these fronting policies. Why? Because ordinarily you can take an income tax deduction for the payment of insurance premiums, and the federal government says no, when you're involved in a fronting policy, this does not constitute insurance, and therefore you cannot take the income tax deduction when we're talking about a fronting policy involving a captive insurer.
Was that the situation with your client?
No, we are not talking about a captive insurance program here, but there's an analogy here, Justice O'Connor, because the analysis used is exactly the same. I was not able to find any cases at all addressing matching deductibles with the income tax cases. That's not to say that the result wouldn't be the same. I don't know the answer to that, because the legal authority that I found did not demonstrate one way or the other with respect to matching deductible cases. But clearly, with respect to captive insurers and reinsurers, which involves the same kind of analysis, where the risk is actually retained by the corporate named insured through a captive insurer, it's the same analysis. Because there is no transfer of risk, there can be no income tax deduction. We also see support drawn out from the regulators in these cases. While the Ohio Department of Insurance has not issued any bulletins or rulings on this particular issue, we have provided this court in our reply brief a report from the Colorado Division of Insurance, which rules that fronting policies using matching deductibles result in no net risk transfer to the insurer. Now, this is important because the lack of regulatory criticism is significant because of the commonality, the fact that fronting policies are so common. If this presented a major problem for the regulators, we would expect to see greater regulatory criticism in this case. And in a case like Ohio, we see pointed out in AIG's amicus brief that some of the largest employers in Ohio, in fact, are parties to fronting policies. In fact, according to AIG, 4 of the top 8 employers in Ohio are parties to fronting policies with AIG itself, including General Motors, Walmart, General Electric, and significantly, the Ohio State University. So apparently, the state of Ohio feels it's appropriate to meet its financial responsibility requirements by entering into a fronting policy with insurers from around the country. Finally, we see that Mr. Gilchrist himself agreed with our position throughout the lower court proceedings, trial court, and in the appellate court, by agreeing essentially that a matching deductible policy, a fronting policy that employs a matching deductible, is a form of self-insurance. It was not until the 8th Appellate District ruled that it was not that he changed his tune and began to argue perhaps that there was some other different course of action or some other different argument should be accepted by this court.
Well, he argues you changed your tune and say this guy isn't covered because he was a pedestrian at the time.
Well, I think we added—
Even if you were required to have coverage here by operation of law. And while we're talking about that, this company's not on the hook, is it? It's your insurance company that's on the hook because you didn't offer it.
That's incorrect. United Rentals actually is the one that's paying me to be here, and it's their money that's on the hook. It's their money that will be involved in this case. If this court imposes underinsured motorist coverage by operational law in this case, United Rentals will pay for it. Absolutely, clearly,
well,
and unequivocally.
Your brief says you're counsel for St. Paul's Fire and Marine and United States Fidelity. It doesn't say anything about United Rentals.
That's correct. And United Rentals is not a named party in this case and is not involved in this case right now, but I can tell you that this will be United Rentals money.
So you're not employed by St. Paul's?
Well, I am. I'm also employed by United Rentals. I represent both.
All right.
There was another question, Justice Pfeiffer?
Yeah, I asked you about the pedestrian aspect of it.
Yeah, the pedestrian aspect of this case is to point out to this court that, in fact, if this court were to impose underinsured motorist coverage by operational law, again, we have a major quandary that happens. Who is an insured then at that point in time? The crux of this case is and always will be for this court whether or not you should impose uninsured motorist coverage by operational law on a fronting policy that involves a matching deductible. But there's a whole host of issues that swirl around this, and one of my jobs as a lawyer is to bring those issues to your attention so that way you can make a reasoned decision based upon what the whole range of issues is, and that's why that's in the brief, Justice Pfeiffer. I see that my time essentially is up with respect to that. I will indicate, just in closing before I turn over the rest of my time for rebuttal, which is that the refiner's case was clear as to why it was setting down the rule of law. Reason and common sense. In refiners, this court unanimously said that if we were to impose underinsured motorist coverage or uninsured motorist coverage by operational law on a self-insurer, quote, it would result in the absurd situation where one has the right to reject an offer of insurance to oneself. Even if applicable, we believe the insurer's rejection must be presumed, end quote. This reasoning has been accepted by 9 of Ohio's 12 appellate districts, and it makes sense. This is United Rentals money in this particular case. We ask this court to reverse the lower court's proceedings. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gardner. Mr. Wakefield.
Good morning. is an insurance policy. It always was an insurance policy. It always will be an insurance policy. And because it is an insurance policy, it is subject to the requirements of 3937.18. This is the biggest smoke and mirror show that has ever been attempted to be shown to this court. What United Rentals slash USF&G, we're not quite sure which, is attempting to do to this court is say that we purchased an insurance company, I mean an insurance policy. We purchased it expressly for the purpose of satisfying the financial responsibility requirements in the state of Ohio. At page 5 in the reply brief, USF&G specifically stated that, quote, at the end of the day, it is important to remember that the USF&G insurance policy is a contract to benefit UIR by serving as proof of financial responsibility. Proof of financial responsibility in the state of Ohio by the statutes, by the law, not by some fabrication made up by the insurance company, not by some fronting policy that doesn't exist in the law, can be satisfied by three major points. It can be satisfied by self-insurance, certified self-insurance. Is United Rentals certified as self-insurance? The answer to the request for admissions in this case say no. It can be satisfied by a bond or some other type of surety. Does United Rentals have a bond in this case? The answer to that case is no. The third way it can be satisfied is through a policy of liability insurance. Does United Rentals have a policy of liability insurance in this case? Yes, they do. They have it through United States Fidelity and Guarantee Company, USF&G. The law is crystal clear, as Justice Piper pointed out, that if you have a policy of liability insurance, you are obligated under the decisions of this court to offer and obtain a knowing rejection of uninsured motorist coverage. As Mr. Garner has admitted, there is no offer, there is no rejection. So therefore, by operation of law, at the very least, uninsured motorist coverage should be applied in this case. A review of the decision of the trial court.
Counselor, who would have offered the uninsured motorist coverage here, given the fact, my understanding, is the company delineated the parameters of their coverage, found the insurer for their needs, admittedly orchestrated this type of coverage called a fronting policy for the purposes of meeting their statutory obligations. And who would have offered that and who would have rejected it under that scenario?
Mr. Garner cited this beautiful quote from the Grange case that said that it would be absurd
exactly.
for a party to offer it to himself.
And reject it,
right.
and et cetera. The
right. Look at the Grange case. In the Grange case, the Grange company is the employer. They would be offering the rejection through the bond to themselves. That's not the case
That's
here.
A bond. We're not talking about a bond.
Right. Well, in Grange, we were dealing with a bond. We're
right.
not dealing with anything
I understand
else.
That. I understand that.
Here, USF&G would be required to make an offer of uninsured motorist coverage to the insured, just like in any other policy. The insured in this case is United Rentals. USF&G retains the ultimate risk in this case by virtue of the bankruptcy provision. USF&G retains the ultimate authority to settle these cases. USF&G retains, by virtue of the provisions of this policy, the right to defend, the right to choose counsel, the right to do absolutely everything above United Rentals.
But that's subject to United Rentals then actually paying the claim.
Only if United Rentals has the ability to pay the claim. If United Rentals doesn't have the ability to pay the claim, the language is very clear that the ultimate authority rests with United States Fidelity and Guarantee Company. In this age where-
Is there any distinction between a certified self-insurer provision and the provision you just mentioned?
A certified self-insurer has to pass specific financial...
No. On that specific point that you brought out about the control of defense and negotiations and how a claim is handled, is that different with a self-insured?
Yes.
A certified self-insured?
Yes, because a certified self-insurer bears the ultimate responsibility. There is no backup. There is no ultimate person behind the certified self-insurer. In this case, there is. And that backup, that person behind it, that entity who bears the ultimate risk is the insurance company. It's not United Rentals. And that distinction is crucial. Because in this case, what they're attempting to do is say, well, we really didn't abide by the law, and we really didn't follow the requirements of doing anything, and we really have an insurance policy. Read the document. It's an insurance policy. But we're asking you to go ahead and say, well, we're close. But since we're close, we should be allowed to go ahead and completely avoid and completely ignore all of the requirements, the statutory obligated requirements, that this court has enforced and that the legislature has set down. The legislature did not put down in anywhere self-insured, practical self-insured, bondholder liability policy. It's a fabrication on the part of the insurance company in order to avoid the coverage.
But our case in Refiner seems to open that door, doesn't it, by talking about practical. You're right, there's nothing in the statute about it, but it's old case. But seems that 1986 case seems that we opened this court opened the door.
You did, Your Honor, in the 1986 case. But in the 1986 case, if you read it carefully, the practical self-insured reference is to another entity that is specifically allowed by statute, and that is the bondholder. Okay? All they're saying is that it's almost the same as a self-insured, but it's permitted under the statute. This action is not permitted under the statute. So that door should be left open, possibly for the crack that exists, but to fling it wide open and allow every insurance company out there and every, quote, self-insured person out there to avoid Ohio's laws by simply saying our matching deductible is equal to the liability policy is unfair to the thousands of people who are injured in the state of Ohio.
Well, Counselor, wait a second. As far as unfairness, when you're talking about a certified self-insurer, which you just said, there is absolutely no backup to a certified self-insurer. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Is not the injured party more secure with this arrangement for a backup source of funds to meet the obligation if there is a judgment award than what the statute actually provides?
Oh, clearly.
So this is a better arrangement for a potentially injured individual, a plaintiff.
If this court chooses to adopt the logic followed by the trial court and the Court of Appeals, if they adopt the logic and oppose coverage as a matter of law because USF&G has failed to follow 393718, it is unequivocally a better situation for the plaintiff. And for that reason, it should be followed, because it does protect the people in the state of Ohio. In this case,
I think you missed her point, at least the point I think she was trying to say is that in a totally certified self-insured, if they go bankrupt, that's it, right?
Correct.
In this case, if you have the same arrangement, but they have an insurance company backing up only in the remote possibility of bankruptcy, there is a safety net that doesn't exist in a totally certified self-insured, correct?
Yes.
And a totally certified self-insured does not required by law to offer uninsured coverage, correct?
Correct.
So in this scenario, your only distinction, I've been trying to follow your arguments, and the only distinction I can see that you are making is that because there is a risk of bankruptcy and the insurance company may have to step in the risk of bankruptcy, therefore we should pull in all of the uninsured motorist coverage provisions.
No. That's not the sole reason. The sole reason is because there is an insurance policy, and under the express language of the statute, a liability insurance policy is something that is obligated to provide uninsured motorist coverage.
But you said the distinction is that they may go bankrupt, and therefore the insurance company may somewhere down the road become liable. Therefore, they should offer uninsured coverage.
I'm sorry if I misspoke on that. What I'm saying is, the USF&G counsel is arguing that this isn't an insurance policy because there isn't any risk to USF&G, and the fact of that is incorrect. There is a risk.
Then the risk, again, it seems to be the bankruptcy.
Yes.
So I think I just went back to my point. I don't see you making a distinction. It's the bankruptcy that is the deciding factor for you, correct?
The risk is a deciding factor, yes, Your Honor.
Counsel, if, correct me where I'm wrong here, it seems to me that under this policy, what this company did is go to this company and say, we don't want to try and comply with all the rules of the various states to be self-insured. So we want a policy of insurance that complies with the mandatory insurance requirements of each and every state in which we operate.
Correct.
And we're willing to pick up the losses that are incurred under that policy.
Correct.
Right. And I think there's even a cover letter, or else it's in the briefs, that's exactly what this company did. They said, okay, here's a policy that comports with all the legal insurance and Bureau of Motor Vehicle requirements for each and every state that you operate in.
Correct.
All right. And I assume that explains why in Nebraska and Oregon and some others, they even have a specific underinsured they speak to the underinsured. I assume in those states it's mandatory that you have it.
Yes.
Would that be correct?
That would be correct, Justice.
So what happened here is in Ohio, they just slipped up. They didn't say to the insurance company, didn't say to the company buying this insurance policy, we have to offer it, and you have to decide whether or not you want it.
Correct. Ohio law requires certain things. USF&G.
So if they had offered it and the company had rejected it, we wouldn't be here.
Correct. USF&G did not comport with the laws of the state of Ohio. They did not offer it. United Rentals specifically says in their brief that because self-insured is, quote, fraught with administrative and legal complications and significant costs, we're going to purchase an insurance policy through USF&G. USF&G dropped the ball. They dropped the ball in the state of Ohio. If they hadn't dropped the ball, Justice Pfeiffer is completely correct. There would have been an offer from USF&G. There would have been a rejection, presumably, by United Rentals, and we wouldn't be here. But that didn't take place. Because it did not take place, this court has stated in a number of instances that coverage must be afforded. The trial court also found, alternatively, that the actual document itself affords coverage. A reading of the trial court's opinion states that coverage was offered in uninsured motorist cases for all entities, all states, where self-insurance was, in fact, required for vehicles that were not insured through insurance policies. Coverage 10. United States USF&G did not provide that coverage in Ohio in a specific declarations page.
But those states are mandatory coverage for that, not an offer and a rejection situation.
Correct.
Well, there's the distinction with what Ohio requires.
Ohio is mandatory until it's rejected, correct? And since it's not rejected.
But the states that you cited do not have the opt-out.
Correct. States that we cited do not. But the language of the policy specifically says that it is provided for all states where certified self-insurance is available, and it was not, quote, not obtained by United Rentals in this case. So therefore, USF&G must afford coverage both under the contractual terms of the policy as well as by operation of law in this case. I'm reminded of the adage, if it walks like a duck, if it talks like a duck, if it quacks like a duck, it must be a duck. This court has held on numerous instances that it is imperative to follow the statutory language and use common sense with respect to this. This is an insurance policy. It looks like an insurance policy. It's captioned as an insurance policy. It follows all the insurance policy forms. Therefore, it is necessary for it to fall under the parameters of 3937.18, and uninsured motorist coverage, since it was neither offered nor objected, must be imposed as a matter of law in the amount of $1 million. The decision of the trial court and the Court of Appeals should be affirmed respectfully. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Wakefield. Mr. Gardner, you've saved just about a minute of your time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Let me begin with a question. How is the risk here assumed by USF&G different than the risk assumed by an insurance company that issues a policy, the so-called catastrophic loss policy, where their risk is fairly limited? There has to be, you know, a certain type of loss. How is, in concept, USF&G's risk different than that?
Well, in USF&G's, if there was not a matching deductible on this policy, Chief Justice Moore, it would be essentially the same as a regular commercial auto policy. But the fact of the matter is with the self-funded retention endorsement, that all the damages and all the claims expenses are retained by United Rentals.
If United Rentals goes bankrupt, I think we agree that then USF&G steps in as they assume the risk.
I believe USF&G would have an issue there where they would have to step in and do that, Your Honor.
So conceptually, how is that different than a policy that says in certain limited situations, catastrophic loss injury to a person will pay, but we won't pay anything below that? And so you have a very discreet type of claim that they will pay, or risk that they've assumed. How is that different than assuming the risk? I mean, bankruptcy is not unheard of, certainly. It's become more common, in fact, than we wish.
Well, when we look at this issue, I have not seen an Ohio case which is dealing specifically with a matching deductible in an insolvency or bankruptcy case. And so I don't want to concede before this court that, in fact, that provision would essentially be waived. I think there are public policy issues we would have to look at and so forth. And this court may well decide under those circumstances that USF&G would have to step in and assume full responsibility for that. But the counterargument to that may well be that you provide what the policy provides, and if the policy says that there's $1 million deductible and that equals the limits of the policy, there may in fact be no coverage provided under those circumstances. However, there are cases which have addressed those situations outside of Ohio which would indicate that public policy perhaps may require that self-insured retention to be pushed aside and to require the insurance company to be liable for that. With respect to your question of the limited risk, I think that essentially this is a full risk commercial auto policy subject to the full matching deductible. And so I think that the scope of the risk, the actual loss that's involved, is broader under this policy. But because the risk is retained by United Rentals, this is the reason why 393718 should not be applied to impose UM coverage by operational law. Because at the end of the day, this is United Rentals money as opposed to the money of the insurer.
If the loss is over the deductible, $1.5 million, I think I saw that. Who's responsible?
There may be excess insurance policies that would kick in at that point in time. And typically, a company like United Rentals will have their self-funded retention or their self-insurance portion, and then after that, they will actually purchase real excess insurance that actually provides a transfer of risk to the excess insurers. And I believe that's the case in this particular case. However, the excess insurance policy was never addressed in this case at the lower courts because we never reached the issue of what the damages were and whether or not it would ever reach that. And so there was never an adverse ruling.
Is that not an important question for us to decide, whether this is a fronting, whether you get the benefit of this fronting policy creation?
I'm sorry.
Well, we're
sure.
Writing law beyond this case. We're writing law that's going to affect a lot of cases, and it may affect a case in which the claimed loss is more than the deductible.
And in a matching deductible case, when we talk about the primary layer of self-insurance, in this case, the $1 million subject to $1 million matching deductible, that would completely remove the primary layer. If we move on to the excess layers, I don't think that there's any, I don't really have any argument with Mr. Wakefield about the fact that if there's an excess insurance policy above this layer, that would then have to provide UM coverage by operational law. The question, of course, would be, do you have to exhaust that first layer? Is there a set-off of $1 million or something like that that takes place for the first layer?
And if there's no excess insurance, if the employer, if the insured decides not to purchase excess insurance,
then there would be no uninsured motorist coverage that would be implicated. even under Mr. Wakefield's theory, because there'd be no insurance company that would be involved. So this is not a suit against the employer. The United Rentals did nothing wrong in this case. This is a suit where he's trying to argue that this policy, which fully complies with all of Ohio's laws, including the uninsured motorist coverage laws, because it is exempt to that extent, he's trying to argue that he's entitled to have underinsured motorist coverage imposed upon this policy by operational law, a concept which, again, is extra statutory created by this court. Thank you. Are there any other questions?
Thank you, Mr. Garner.
Thank
the case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.